This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today, we take you back to the year 1919. Peter Fukunaga took out a $1,500 loan to open a two-car garage on Oahu's North Shore. The company he created was Servco, and it has since grown into a $1.8 billion business, distributing and selling cars and home appliances, car sharing, and investing. To celebrate its 100 years in business, the company gave $1.5 million to local charities throughout the year. This included $20,000 grants awarded to 19 nonprofits spread across the state who were nominated by customers. It's also donated $200,000 to Aloha United Way, which, by the way, is celebrating its 100 years this year. It was to start the Hawaii Social Impact Project to help those in the state living from paycheck to paycheck. Mark Fukunaga is the chairman and CEO of the company and also the founder's grandson. He sat down with our producer, Jason Ubai, to talk about how the business has changed since those early days.
Well, it's been an interesting journey. We used to have all kinds of businesses. You know, my grandfather and then my father and uncles who continued the business were really entrepreneurial. So they got into a lot of stuff. I think in the last 25 years, we've really rationalized and focused the business on automotive. So that really is our business now. Maybe what's changed is that while we have obviously a big presence in Hawaii, about half of our company now is in Australia. So we expanded there about 12 years ago. So we're in, altogether, we've, as we say in the automotive business, we've got 27 rooftop locations in Australia, and it's everywhere from, you know, the major cities, Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, and then a lot of other smaller cities and towns, really across Australia, all the way to Perth.
Well, do you see yourself expanding in Australia, New Zealand, or any other places outside of Hawaii?
Yeah, I think we'll continue to do Australia, potentially New Zealand. But I think at the same time, you know, like a lot of businesses, we're facing some big disruption down the road. We foresee maybe more change in the next 10 years than in the prior 100 years of the automotive industry. So we're looking at everything from, you know, going online in engaging our customers as opposed to brick and mortar locations. We'll do both, but I think increasingly online. You've got new ownership models, ride sharing and car sharing. You know, our initiative with Toyota, and Toyota's only and first, rather, first global car sharing initiative was with us. And that's the Hui car sharing service you see all around Honolulu. Autonomous cars are also coming. That's a game changer. And that's not that far away in terms of being able to use autonomous vehicles in certain geographic areas in good weather, which we are lucky to have. So I would not be at all surprised to see that coming maybe 7 to 10 years out. Wow. in a significant way.
Has Toyota been working with you guys on autonomous vehicles?
Yeah, we've been talking with them, and I think every manufacturer, along with Google, Uber, you name it, you know, there are a lot of folks working in the area, along with a bunch of startups as well. But we've had, I guess because our history with Toyota has been such a long one, since 1958, we have collaborated with Toyota over, you know, 60 years doing various things. You know, it goes back to even the early 60s when they developed the first cars for export to the U.S. Our technicians were working alongside their engineers. So it's been a great history of collaboration. And now with Hui Car Sharing, you know, we've done with them. We've put the state's only hydrogen filling station, constructed it. It is now pumping hydrogen for Toyota hydrogen fuel cell cars out of Mapunapuna.
Can you talk a bit more about the hydrogen versus electric vehicles? I think most people are thinking, you know, electric vehicles are where the market's heading and how there's more cars in that area. But why hydrogen, and why is Servco and Toyota kind of pursuing this alternative fuel?
We don't think it's a choice of one or the other. So we think of it as another sustainable technology that is useful for applications alongside electric vehicles. I mean, I think we all realize that climate change is a very, very serious existential problem ahead of us. We have to fix it. And part of that is electric vehicles. We think electric vehicles will have a place, particularly in urban areas and shorter ranges. And in that context, they're terrific. But you do need long recharge times. And at certain points, you do have limits in terms of range, although that has certainly improved. Hydrogen, and you can see it, you know, today in our station, Mapunapuna, it's a five-minute fill-up. It is almost exactly like filling up with gas. 5 minutes, fully filled up, and then you're good to go over 300 miles. So if you're looking for something that is easy, that works for long distances, and in particular works for larger vehicles and trucks, because at a certain point, both hydrogen vehicles and electric vehicles use an electric motor to move. Electric vehicles use a big battery. Hydrogen uses a tank of hydrogen. At a certain point, particularly with bigger vehicles, it's a lot lighter to use a tank of hydrogen to power the electric motor as opposed to a big, heavy lithium battery that has its own disposal challenges down the road. So in terms of long-term technology, we really think fuel cells are the way to go, but we also think that electric vehicles have a place as well. And Toyota is about to launch electric vehicles, a line of electric vehicles in the not-too-distant future.
How far in the future do you think that'll be, the electric, full electric?
Full electric?
Yeah.
Gosh, that's a great question. I think I would be surprised if, you know, by the mid-2020s, I think every manufacturer will have a significant lineup of electric vehicles. And at minimum, I think most of their lineup will be hybrid or plug-in hybrids. So I think gas engines will be in a shrinking minority as the 20s progress. And then probably in 10 years, you know, it'll be largely plug-in hybrids, electric vehicles, and fuel cells.
What else is coming up on your radar in the car industry here locally?
Yeah, well, it's, I think, you know, for 100 years, we've been a product-based company. We sell vehicles and then we service them, and which has been a great business. I think increasingly we're looking at mobility, not just in terms of selling the cars, but providing transportation. And in doing so, really being a service provider. So we're moving from being a product company to a service company and providing things like car sharing, ride sharing potentially. We're exploring smart shuttles, smart carpooling. And we just think that ultimately everyone will use a spectrum of transportation options, and we should be there for all of that in some way, helping people get from A to B through any mode that they can. And we also see ourselves, in a sense, helping things like rail, because someone is still going to have to get from the first mile and the last mile to the station. So we hope that, you know, maybe these panoply of transportation options will be really needed. I mean, we expect them to be really needed, and we're positioning what we do to serve that.
So can you tell me about Servco Labs and Servco's digital transformation?
Yeah, that's one of the other big changes in the business. Like everything else today, a lot of what we do is digital. You know, it's online, and obviously we all use it in all kinds of ways. We've realized that we've had to ramp up our digital engagement with customers. So we've ramped up our folks who work in that area. And as part of that, we've created something called Servco Labs. And it's this incubator for innovation within the company. And frankly, we think of it as not just for the company, but for the community as well. And it's getting the right talent in a room, dealing with some interesting problems, and using all of our digital know-how to maybe do things more responsively, faster, better, and in many cases, reinventing what we do. We've been really lucky to have some wonderful, talented people join us. We had a terrific internship program in the summer. We brought back to Hawaii, I think, a bunch of college students who loved working with us over the summer. And I think maybe the most satisfying part is a couple of them said, I hadn't planned to come back to Hawaii. And these are our best and brightest. And they said at the end of summer, wow, I didn't realize a company like this existed. And you've kind of changed my thoughts about coming home. I will come home now. Well, so I think if we can keep doing stuff like that under our Servco Labs initiative, it's wonderful on all kinds of fronts. You know, it helps us as a company, but potentially bringing back some of our best and brightest to work in further innovation in the state. That would be terrific.
So are they developing apps or what? I guess what kind of projects are being researched at Servco Labs?
Yeah, I mean, everything from developing apps to data analytics, kind of really getting the data and being able to figure out what we're doing or not doing well, trying different ideas out in terms of, you know, A-B testing. You try one thing, try another thing, see which one works better. Yeah, in just all kinds of ways, working with data, working with artificial intelligence, I think increasingly, thinking about how that, not to take out jobs, but to make work a lot more effective and ultimately more fun by maybe using AI to do some of the tough, nitty-gritty, boring analyses that used to be done by people can be done by AI, and you free up humans to do what they do best, which is interact with folks, think, and figure out next steps.
Okay. So you see this as a business application. Does it affect the consumers?
I think ultimately, yeah, because I think if we can figure out how to do things better and to make the customer's experience more rewarding, more useful, easier, it helps everybody.
Yep.
And so certainly in terms of how we do business with our folks, how we serve people, we can be quicker and more complete. But I think also, you know, we've taken a spot at the Sandbox, that Innovation Center in Kakaako.
Yeah.
We have an office there with our folks. And we like to think, you know, being part of this bigger community of innovation will help everybody in Hawaii.
That was Mark Fukunaga talking about Servco's future. Aside from cars, the company is also co-majority owner of Fender Guitars. And while you won't see a Fender guitar store in Hawaii, Servco once counted Easy Music Center among its many holdings.
Sometimes scrolling through social media makes us upset, and yet we can't turn away.
I would read something, I would feel outraged about it, I would feel compelled to share it with my friends. I would then be sort of obsessively checking to see whether people had responded, how they had responded, you know, lather, rinse, repeat.
How outrage hijacks our minds, this week on Hidden Brain.
Tonight at 7, following Says You.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we're mixing up a popular cocktail to test your knowledge about one of the most recognizable drinks in the islands. It's blue, it's sweet, and it shares the same name as an Elvis Presley flick. As the story goes, back in 1957, a young Waikiki bartender by the name of Harry Yee was asked by a foreign distiller to create a drink promoting their blue curacao liqueur. Well, Yee's original recipe called for 3/4 ounce of vodka, 3/4 ounce of light Puerto Rican rum, 1/2 ounce of blue curacao, and 1 ounce of sweet and sour, and 3 ounces of fresh pineapple juice. All ingredients were poured over ice, stirred in a clear hurricane glass, and aficionados of this classic cocktail advise sticking to fresh ingredients. Avoid cheap liquor, canned pineapple juice, and corn syrup mixed with artificial flavors. For today's quiz, we want to know the name of the company that approached Harry Yee over 6 decades ago, allowing him to dream up the blue Hawaii, whose hue is as beautiful as the Pacific on a sunny day. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Thank you. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. The Spring Wind Quintet performs Hungarian and Czech music of Rijka, Ligeti, and Chervansky, November 4th, 11th, and 12th. Tickets at chambermusichawaii.org.
Stories that ring true and touch the heart can be the most powerful storytelling with impact. That's the theme of the upcoming Media Makers Summit, sponsored by the group PIC, Pacific Islanders in Communications. It takes place at the Convention Center November 5th. It'll be followed the next day by the first ever event, Good Pitch Local Hawaii, which aims at getting feedback and maybe funding for film projects in progress. Joe Wilson is with the Pitch Project, and PIC's Executive Director, Leanne Ferrer, joined us in studio this week to tell us what's in store.
Pacific Islanders in Communications has had two other conferences. This year, it's bigger and grander, so we're calling it the PIC Media Makers Summit, and it's going to be at the Hawaii Convention Center, and it's a great chance to bring media makers together and network. We're going to bring in people from all over, from the Redford Center, from Sundance, from Tribeca, National PBS. And so it's a chance for our media makers here to meet funders, to meet distributors, national distributors, and just to get to put a face to names and get to know one another.
And for folks who don't know, PIC is funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And so this then will really kind of give people kind of a snapshot into the world of PBS, I guess, right?
It will. In fact, we're going to have a breakout session or a kind of a whole track of sessions with what is public media and why is it important. And, you know, HPR is part of public media, and PIC is, and PBS Hawaii is. So it'll be really great to explain to the younger generations why we're here and why we're here for them.
Right, and the whole idea is to be able to grow our pool of filmmakers locally, because we have the best stories to tell, and we just need to either find the mentors, but give them a chance to be able to understand, I guess, the landscape out there.
We do. We need to harness all these great stories, and we also need to train people to tell their stories through their own perspective and their own lens. We don't want people coming here and telling our stories for us.
And Joe, jump in here, because mm-hmm. you've got another event that follows this summit, and it's kind of the debut event, right? It's the first time that you folks
are
doing it.
It's the first time that it's being done in Hawaii. It's an event called Good Pitch Local Hawaii, and this concept of Good Pitch was created about 10 years ago by an organization, a nonprofit called the Doc Society, which is based in London and New York. And they created this idea in partnership with the Sundance Institute and the Ford Foundation, all organizations that have for a long time supported the idea of documentary film to raise awareness and promote action on important issues of concern, social, economic, political, et cetera, in communities around the world. The idea behind the Good Pitch is to select a or curate a program of films that are going to be launched soon and have an intention to create social impact. And the forum, or the day of the pitch, assembles people from the philanthropic, from the social service, from community advocacy, government, policymaking, all in the same room together with the intention of contributing what they can to make sure that these films, and more importantly, the goals that they have associated with them, have impact to create common good in communities around the world.
And I love that we've got the synergy going because it's right before the Hawaii International Film Festival kicks off. But it's really a chance to, I guess, hone in on the different, dimensions, I guess, of filmmakers that we've got in our community.
It's tremendously exciting. So, of course, we're really excited to be doing this work in partnership with Pacific Islanders and Communications, who, as you know, for a long time has been supporting the media making and storytelling community here in Hawaii. And what we think Good Pitch brings to the table is an opportunity to foster deeper collaboration between and among community activists, media makers who have important stories to tell, but need additional resources through which to do that, in addition to money. I mean, everybody knows to do a project, you need money. But often what people who are either in the activist or media-making world are lacking are the important relationships that are necessary to lift those projects off the ground. So through this work, we want to make sure that people who are telling important stories in Hawaii have the resources to do it, and that those stories have the potential not just to be seen and heard and have impact in Hawaii, but to go much further.
Right, because there's a whole distribution world out there. It's not just creating your gem and your story and getting it on film, but making sure people will get their eyes on it.
Exactly.
The more eyes on it, the more audience they reach, the more all that work they did, all that love they put into the film will just get out there. And that's what we want to help.
And there are a number of films that have been funded by PIC that have been shown at HIF.
Yes. So PIC has been sponsoring the Pacific Showcase at HIF for 10 years now. And that's another collaboration that we and the Good Pitch Hawaii Local will roll right into HIF. And just that, like you said, the word synergy, mm-hmm. you know, we'll just keep that ball rolling with our local films.
We just had a filmmaker join us in studio, and you were talking about the morphing of Kuleana and Kuleana Maui and Maui, and how it debuted as one thing and is changing names as it goes through the distribution in order to get eyes on it.
Sometimes we have to do that just to reach a broader audience, but the storyline doesn't change and the mana'o behind it doesn't change. I was going to say the great thing about something like the Good Pitch Local is that PIC funds films. We fund films with Pacific Islander stories, but we only give partial funding. Like, the filmmakers have to get out and raise money themselves. Good Pitch gives that extra push to help them finish projects.
And so, Joe, talk about how this is going to work. If folks want to take part in this,
sure.
What do they have to do?
Yeah, so Leanne and I, along with a large kind of committee of people, have been putting this together for the past year, right, laying the groundwork for this, raising awareness among all the different organizations and community activists and media makers here in Hawaii to first curate a program. So we have 13 projects that have been selected that we've been working with over the past several months to make sure that they're preparing their pitches so that on the day of November 6th at the Vai Vai Collective, which is where the event will take place all day from 8 to 4, when they step into the spotlight, they are ready to, you know, give the best possible pitch for their project so that the people that we have assembled in the room that day, approximately 125 to 150 people, we're hoping, will be in the room with us that day, people from local foundations, people from nonprofits, people from government agencies, community organizations, people from local production houses and media makers, anybody who feels that they have a gift in the broadest sense of the word to contribute to people who are doing important projects. Will step up once they hear that pitch and say, that's an issue that's important to me. I have something to contribute, and I'd like to help. How can I help?
Right, so it's getting good feedback from people in the know in the industry. It's kind of like, what is that, Shark Tank?
People often compare it to a Shark Tank, and on some levels that's true because people are got to step up and, you know, and deliver the best possible, what they call elevator pitch in 3 or 4 minutes to present their story, to present how they're going to do it and what impact they hope to have. But in this sense, it's the opposite in that it's not competitive. It is intended to be a loving embrace. Everybody comes into the room on that day to say, I'm here to help. Once I listen to what the stories are and what your intentions are, I'm going to step up to the plate and say, here's what I want to contribute and here's how I want to make sure that your project is successful.
So it's kind of a bit more collaborative, I guess.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah. We're really excited about the dynamic collaboration that has the potential to be unleashed.
We tell everyone, when you're there to support. You're there to, and the offers aren't necessarily money. Everyone needs money, every filmmaker, every person
right.
doing a project. What we want the ask to be is something that they do need, but it's not necessarily cash. So someone could say, I need a cameraman, or I need someone to help me go through these city permits, or I need a lawyer to help us draft up contracts.
Exactly. Or once I have my project completed, I'd love to do a series of community screenings across the islands. Is there a network of community orgs, or does anybody know how to get into the libraries or the public schools, et cetera, just to use these opportunities to create ways for people to come together in communities, watch a story together, and then have a dialogue about it and talk about, well, what do we do about this problem?
So that way you're not kind of like recreating the wheel and expending a lot of energy.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the whole idea behind, I think, what PIC does, what's so exciting about bringing Pacific Islander stories to the fore is, you know, it's one thing to hear about issues. It's another to connect with people through the power of storytelling. You know, it reaches... A good story or an important story well told can touch you in your heart. It can touch you in your emotions. And in that way, it allows us to identify with people in communities that might not be the community we're from, but then we can walk in their shoes, see things through different people's perspectives, and then form kind of, you know, common bonds about how we're going to address things that affect all of us. Yeah, it's really exciting.
Mm-hmm. And then, Leanne, I just know from watching from the outside, now stepping away from PIC from the early days, it's just so gratifying to see the quality of work that is being broadcast on PBS and abroad. You know, it's just the fact that our communities are telling stories that are important to us.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that there is a vast audience out there that wants to watch, wants to learn. We're not making these films just for Pacific Islander communities. In fact, a lot of the feedback we get are from non-Pacific Islanders who remember vacations they've had in Hawaii. Oh. Or like Joe was saying, I didn't know you guys felt the same way or did the same thing. And it's really great. And right now at PIC, we have two national series. We have Pacific Heartbeat, which is an anthology series that is going into its 9th season nationally on PBS. And then we have Family Ingredients, which is going into its 3rd season. So there's a hunger out there to see our stories.
Yeah, lots to be proud of when we see the quality of shows that are being shared across the globe.
It's true. I mean, I think everybody in Hawaii now feels that these are really momentous times here in the islands based on issues that are unfolding in communities on all of the islands. And I think the program, at least at the Good Pitch, really reflects that. So we, of the 13 projects, we have several that are addressing issues that are relate to the movement that's unfolding on Mauna Kea, to communities, you know, across the islands, inspired by that level of stepping up and claiming a way to preserve, protect cultural integrity here in Hawaii. We have several projects that address what migrants and immigrants face in Hawaii, what young people are facing when it comes to human trafficking here in the islands, ways to, you know, prevent abuse and exploitation of young, marginalized, at-risk populations here. We have, what's really cool about this Good Pitch, I think, in that previously they have been focused on the documentary form. What the Good Pitch local model opens up is stories being told in the best way that suits that story. So we have a couple short narrative film projects that have come through the PIC process that are bringing forward. One's a great one about the legacy of George Helm, you know, whose work back in the 70s inspired the Hawaiian Renaissance. And it's re-inspiring the whole idea of what does it mean to aloha aina now. So I think that's going to be a very impactful project. And another one that looks at the ways in which, in particular, Native Hawaiian communities can often be pitted against each other. So it's a story that looks at the life of a Native Hawaiian man who happens to be in law enforcement, who at a particular moment is forced to confront his own family who are on the opposite sides of a conflict in the community. And I think it's going to be a beautiful way to try to kind of reconcile some of those challenges communities are going through. And we have other projects that are dealing with ocean conservation, environmental challenges that are going on, projects that relate to climate change and how we deal with climate change here in the islands, et cetera.
So a real plethora of subject matter.
Exactly.
I imagine there's going to be some crossover, folks that are going to be going to the Media Maker Summit and then also to Good Pitch.
There definitely is, and that's why it was so synchronistic and so intersectional that we have our summit right before the Good Pitch, and they'll wake up the next day and we'll go down to the Vai Vai Collective and share our guests that were on the panels the day before. And so it's a great way for anyone out there to come and meet people from these organizations. I mentioned Sundance and Tribeca. We also have people from the World Channel. We have, let's see, who else? Oh, we have representatives from FIFO, the Tahiti Film Festival, and the Guam International Film Festival. And so it's a really easy way to come to the summit, get to network with people, and then if the Good Pitch still has room, because it's filling up fast,
more than enough room for everybody. Yeah.
Then, being in the room with everyone with that collective good energy and those great vibes. Exactly.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
Well, thank you both so much for sitting down with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah.
That was Joe Wilson and Leanne Ferrer talking about two upcoming events for potential filmmakers, the Media Makers Summit and Good Pitch Local Hawaii, which is an inaugural event set for the first week of November. November 6th is when the U.S. Supreme Court is set to hear a Maui water case. That's our reality check today. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Nathan Eagle joins us with the latest. Good morning, Nathan.
Hey, good morning.
So this is really setting up to be a major power struggle between the mayor and the council there on Maui.
It really is. I mean, what started over a fight over the Clean Water Act and laws there has switched to who has control over settling big lawsuits like this, the council or the mayor's office.
Now, there's been a lot of hand-wringing over this just because people fear that if it goes up to the Supreme Court, the decision might not be real good for the environmental landscape.
There's a lot of concern about that, especially among the environmental groups who brought the case all the way back in 2012. They're saying, hey, we've got a conservative-leaning Supreme Court. Let's not take that chance and risk potentially gutting the Clean Water Act, which would affect not just, of course, Maui's waters, but the entire country's rivers, lakes, oceans, near shore waters. And so they just want to settle it and be done.
And now just the other week, the council basically voted to settle this, and the mayor's just said no.
Exactly. They're saying it's unprecedented. They haven't really seen this before. There is a related case that happened on Oahu a while back with former Mayor Harris. But, yeah, the council thought, hey, we're done with this. We finally got the votes. It was still close, 5-4. But we voted to settle last month. Let's be done. But the mayor decided, no, we're just not going to do that. Thanks for the recommendation. He's being advised by corporation counsel attorneys over there. And so that puts us into this uncharted territory. And so that's what they're trying to get to the bottom of now. We may even see a new lawsuit filed as soon as today that could ask a judge to step in and decide who has the power.
And your story brings out that Maui's charter is a little different, you know, from other jurisdictions like here in Honolulu. Talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. The biggest difference is that when the law is a little unclear over on Maui, they're looking at the county charter, county code. They have a provision that says basically the council has the authority in that instance. And so the county council is looking at that and saying, hey, we think it's really unclear. So we're looking at section 2.2 of the charter and saying that, well, we have the authority then, kind of the tiebreaker of sorts.
Right. So it's a kind of a tug of war over whose kuleana is it, I guess.
It really is.
And so I guess we'll wait to see whether there's a new filing today, but then, you know, what happens after that?
Yeah, so we'll be watching for that. And, of course, if that does get filed as expected, I imagine the judge would be encouraged at a minimum to decide something quickly. But absent that, or even possibly with that ongoing, attorneys are already, from what I'm told, practicing. They're doing moot courts and stuff. They are gearing up for this November 6th opening arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court. So everyone's kind of saying, hey, we got to get ready regardless. Let's do this.
So you think, though, that there might be a way to be able to break this logjam, though, if something gets filed and we go through this, we think, an expedited process?
I think there's a chance. It's still a little unclear, again, because I haven't seen the filings yet. But one thing that another attorney did make clear is that even if they go through and hit that November 6th date, they do the opening arguments, they can still apparently settle after that. And so that Supreme Court process, they're thinking earliest would be maybe a spring kind of decision. So there's still some time there.
Oh, I see. Okay. And then I imagine, though, that we just would want some clarification for Maui County. You know, who's the boss on this?
Absolutely. And that's their big concern, too, is like, okay, this is affecting this specific case now, but we could easily see ourselves running into this again going down the road. So let's go ahead and get some clarity.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of people would support that regardless of what happens on November 6th. Okay,
absolutely.
Well, we'll have to see. I'm sure you'll be, like I said, checking the filings for the rest of the day.
Definitely.
Okay. Thanks so much, Nathan.
Thank you.
That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's reality check. To read his full story, go to civilbeat.org.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dr. Isaac Bentwich, author of Gita, A Timeless Guide for Our Time. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about the profound wisdom of this ancient text.
Sunday morning at 11.
When Ira Glass created This American Life, he revolutionized auditory storytelling. Now's your chance to see and hear him in person. Join HPR and Hawaii Theater Center Saturday, December 21st for Ira Glass's one-man show, his first performance ever in Hawaii, plus a Q&A with the audience. We're giving HPR members early access to the best seats now before they open to the general public. Get yours at hprtickets.org.
Earlier in the show, we delved into the history of the iconic cocktail called the Blue Hawaii. It was dreamed up by Waikiki bartender Harry Yee, who began his career in 1952 and went on to serve as Hilton Hawaiian Village's head barman for 30 years. As the story goes, Dutch distiller Bowles approached Yee in 1957 to come up with a recipe to promote their Blue Curacao liqueur. Harry rose to the challenge and came up with this. In a 12-ounce glass, put ice, and then add in this order: 3 ounces of fresh pineapple juice, 1 ounce sweet and sour, 1/2 ounce of Bowles Blue Curacao, 3/4 ounce of vodka, and 3/4 ounce of Puerto Rican rum. Stir gently, garnish with pineapple slice and Vanda orchid. Known as the king of tropical cocktails, Yee is credited with creating over a dozen tropical drinks, including the Hawaiian Cooler, the Banana Daiquiri, and the Tropical Itch. If you look at the timeline, Elvis fans will realize that the drink came before the movie. In fact, Yee has said that his inspiration for the Blue Hawaii came from the 1937 Bing Crosby film Waikiki Wedding. And drumroll please, the winner today is Ron Davidson. He's from the Big Island, the Waikoloa Resort. He's a cocktail engineer, so he knew the answer. He mixes the Blue Hawaii a lot, and he shares with us that he was able to actually visit the Dutch distiller Bowles on a recent visit. Thanks so much for calling. But that's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. So we have cocktails on our cerebral radar, not just any cocktails, but crazy rich cocktails. That's the title of an event happening tonight as part of the Hawaii Food and Wine Festival. And one of the special guests happens to be mixologist Julie Reiner. Within hours of arriving back home yesterday, she headed out to Waimanalo Beach to get refreshed in a kind of ocean cocktail. Reiner, whose family still lives here in the islands, is an author, New York bar owner, and was named one of the top 10 mixologists in the world. We talked to her about her roots here and taking the culinary approach to cocktailing.
Well, I mean, I started cocktail waitressing in Waikiki when I was in high school. You know, I was like a senior in high school. I was a cocktail waitress. And, you know, I was always looking at what was happening and what the people behind the bar were doing. And I, you know, wanted to get back there. And so when I went to college, I bartended in college and then had moved to San Francisco. And that was really kind of where I started taking a more culinary approach to cocktails. And then moved to New York and kind of the rest is history. I ended up, putting out just more of a culinary style of drinks with fresh squeezed juices and syrups. And in the late 90s, that was kind of groundbreaking material, which now not so much. But it landed me, you know, on the front page of the food section of the New York Times and started a big career in the bar biz.
It's just amazing, and it's pretty thrilling for folks, you know, to see, you know, your rise. You know, you've done a book. You got nominated for a James Beard, and I mean, it's really cool stuff.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a fun industry, and certainly it's kind of funny because I went to La Pietra for high school, and I looked back. I found it the other day because I moved, and my yearbook, I wrote in there, you know, I wanted to have a job that's more of a hobby than a job, and I see myself living in a big city. I was like, well, that ended up happening.
Well, so, you know, being here in Hawaii, you know, we've got such wonderful flavors to choose from. So how do you incorporate, you know, maybe the flavors that you enjoyed growing up with into any of your drinks?
Yeah, I mean, you know, modern tropical is definitely a style that I've always taken to my cocktails. You know, I had a lychee tree in the front yard and a mango tree in the backyard. And so, you know, growing up with all of those tropical flavors gave me just like a real kind of toolkit, you know, of delicious, you know, island style flavor to use in cocktails. So I kind of gravitated towards that from a very young age. But yeah, I'm always looking to use the flavors of the islands in cocktails.
You're here for the Food and Wine Festival, and you're going to be doing a crazy cocktail event.
Yes, the Crazy Rich Asians event.
So what do you have lined up for that?
I'm going to do two different cocktails for that event. One of them has a pretty new Italian bitter to it. It's called Italicus. It's kind of a punch-style cocktail, a little bit of grapefruit, some raspberry, you know, really just kind of a nice, long drink that's tasty. And then I'm also doing a stirred drink with Japanese whiskey, which I thought would be a good accompaniment. So one kind of boozier, stronger drink and a nice sort of sipper, kind of a spritz variation, if you will.
And then when you lived in San Francisco, I don't know, was there a takeaway from that town? I mean, I know living in North Beach, I just think of like Campari and soda. You know,
oh,
those
yeah,
bitters.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think, you know, when I living in San Francisco, I kind of learned really how to drink cocktails. When I lived there, I was there in my 20s, and yeah, I was drinking Negronis and Manhattans and kind of learning more about classic cocktails being in SF. But there were a lot of women behind the bar as well in San Francisco, which was refreshing, and there was lots of opportunity there.
Did you find it hard to break in as a mixologist?
Well, you know, when I first started out, that wasn't even really a term that was being used so much. I think, you know, because from growing up here, I always wanted to use fresher ingredients in my drinks. And San Francisco, when I was in San Francisco, their fresh juice was kind of the norm. But when I got to New York, that wasn't the case. People were still using like sour mix on the gun. And so, you know, when I started doing my own sort of infusions and making tea syrups and doing, you know, my own syrups from scratch, it was kind of groundbreaking stuff at the time. And, you know, that term was kind of something that the media created to separate somebody who was doing the kind of stuff that I was doing from somebody who was pouring beers and pints and making, you know, whiskey and ginger or something like that, you know. And it took off.
Well, yeah, I mean, it there's an art to this.
Absolutely. There is definitely an art to it, and it's been really an amazing ride to kind of watch it grow and see, you know, some of the people that worked with us early on have gone on to open their own bars, and, you know, I learned from them, you know, and just seeing all the things that have gone on all over the world is incredible.
If there was something, let's say, that you just discovered maybe this year in your travels, what would that be?
Gosh, well, I was just in Glasgow for World Class, which is one of the biggest cocktail competitions in the world. And, you know, every year, it's a really cool thing because I get basically a front row seat to the best bartenders from every country. So I'm always really inspired to see what they're doing. There was a lot of sesame in cocktails this year, which I hadn't seen in the past. But yeah, the young and upcoming bartenders trying to put out drinks that have ingredients that we haven't seen before are always very inspiring and give me a lot to think about in drinks, you know, from my own places.
Sesame as in sesame seed or sesame paste?
Sesame, both. It was interesting because, you know, one of the competitions that I judged, we had like three different competitors that one of them used like a sesame oil in a martini variation. Another one used sesame paste. Another one used sesame seeds infused, you know. So, yeah, which is not something that I saw, you know. It kind of gives a little bit more of an umami flavor and a savory note to cocktails.
So is wasabi used a lot?
Wasabi?
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's super popular, but you see it a lot in, like, Bloody Mary, you know, Bloody Marys. A lot of people will do, like, an Asian version of a Bloody Mary with wasabi. We have one at Clover Club that we use wasabi and fish sauce in, and, you know,
ooh,
it's delicious.
That sounds interesting.
Sounds crazy, but it's good.
Or, you know, do you use something like, I don't know, turmeric or galangal, you know, just the things you'd see in the Asian markets in Chinatown?
Yeah, for sure. You see, I mean, at this point, I feel like I've seen it all. Not always successfully, but, you know, bartenders do what we call shopping the shelves and just grabbing different ingredients and things that maybe they haven't tasted before and just trying to incorporate it into a cocktail, which is always interesting.
Yeah, I imagine, you know, there's a lot of the experimentation and deconstructing and having fun, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, at the end of the day, it's fun. You know, our job is to make people happier than they were when they walked into our bar. So, you know, if we could do that, we're succeeded.
Now, you've also written a book, and I saw some of the online comments. Someone says, oh, yeah, I saw it in the library. And, you know, so that must be kind of a real charge to know that, you know, you have a go-to book.
Yeah, you know, well, I wanted to write a book. I would get so many emails from family and friends asking what they should make for Thanksgiving or what they should make for Christmas dinner, you know, for the family. And so I did a book that my book is really geared towards home bartending. You know, what if you have a group of 20 people coming over, what should you make? And if you just have a couple friends, and then how to build your home bar. And, you know, they're all recipes that are very approachable and pretty easy to be successful with at home.
That's pretty neat, you know, to know that it's in the library.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I know. My mom loves it. My mom is going through the book and making, you know, one drink at a time, which is very cute. It's great to have a book and know that people enjoy it and that it's helping.
So do you have a favorite cocktail at the moment?
You know, I mean, my favorite cocktail is generally a seasonal kind of a thing. I would say that I probably drink more Negronis than anything else year-round, but in the wintertime, I am all about Manhattan. Summertime, you know, agave, tequila cocktails, I love, you know, a daiquiri, just a classic daiquiri. I can't really beat that. I always say that you drink a daiquiri while you decide what you actually want to drink from a menu.
And so now that you're back home and, you know, you're going to be in Waikiki, is there a favorite haunt you go to for a drink?
Pint and Jigger, which is kind of off the path there, is great. Justin Park's Bar Leather Apron is doing some incredible stuff over Chinatown side. Those are two of my absolute go-tos. A lot of cool bars in Chinatown. I've heard there's a new tiki bar that I have to check out.
Oh, yes, you do.
That's on my list. I haven't been there yet. Yeah, but those are some of the faves. And, of course, I always have to go and have a Mai Tai at the Halekulani at the House Without a Key and sit outside and look at that view. That's another must-do when I'm here.
Right. And you can always go to La Mariana and have a beer.
Yeah, I love La Mariana, too. That's a good one. You know, I love Hawaii food and wine. It's such a great opportunity to come home and share some of the things that we do. You know, every year I coordinate with the Chandra and Southern Wine and Spirits to bring over the top bar talent across the U.S. And this year we have some incredible bartenders. The American Bartender of the Year, Julio Cabrera, is here. We've got some awesome people. So I'm excited to share that with everybody on island.
And that was our toast to Julie Reiner, La Pietra grad and 2011 nominee of a James Beard Award. She'll be featured at a Crazy Rich cocktail event at Alohilani Resort tonight, as well as the Food and Wine Festival Indulge Gala at the Halekulani Hotel on Sunday. That winds it up for today. Up tomorrow, we talk about drawing the line as pushback from the Mauna expands here on Oahu. We talk about the recent vandalism at the Kahuku Wind Farm Project. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line, 808-972-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.